The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest, You Don't Get to Hate It edition. It's Wednesday, June 19th, 2019. On today's show, the joyously slick and pulpy California noir Big Little Lies returns to HBO for season two. It was already a star-studded cast. It's now joined by the starriest, studiest of them all, by Meryl Streep. Can't wait to discuss it. And then The Last Black Man in San Francisco was a darling at Sundance. It's now being released to theaters. It's a wise and mournful elegy to a relentlessly gentrified city and to the place its black residents have found and lost within it. Finally, we're going to discuss for the first time Sims, the video game, which is in its fourth installment and has been for a while, but is now available for free on PC, which has led some critics and fans to reflect on its impact. Joining me today is Marissa Martinelli, who is an editor at Slate. Marissa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And of course, Willa Paskin is Slate's TV critic. Willa, welcome back.
Hi.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Big Little Lies season one was a taut, funny California noir combined with a school drop-off comedy of manners. It focused on four women, principally all mothers with kids at the local public school, and all with pretty whopping secrets, as it turns out. Their nerve-stretch relationships with their spouses and one another were at the heart of the season one, and really at the heart of it all was violence, marital violence, between Nicole Kidman's character Celeste and her husband Perry, played by Alexander Skarsgård. There was something I thought really unique. I finally finished watching season one. It's dreamy and voyeuristic. It's very sexy. It's very catchy, but it's also wise in my estimation about both marital and class politics. And it was a hit. It also came to a pretty decisive climax at the end of season one. So the question, as always with such shows, is how do you do season two? I should say before we dig in that there's no way really to do justice to discussing season two without spoiling season one. If you haven't watched season one, you should watch season one, and then you should come back and listen to this segment. But let's dive in. Why don't we listen to a clip, and then I can't wait to ask you how you find the second season.
But Celeste tells me that you continue to be so helpful with her and the boys, and
she should just get a proper housekeeper. You're very short.
Excuse me?
I don't mean it in a negative way.
Oh.
Maybe I do. I find little people to be untrustworthy. My apologies. It's just that I pride myself on being a very good judge of character, but you have always presented such a difficult read. You know, you seem like a nice person, loving, but also you strike me as a wanter.
Oh, a wanter.
Mm. You know, there are people in life who content themselves with what they have, and then there are others who just want.
I'm not a wanter.
Oh, you don't have to take it personally. Anyway, I'm a wanter myself. You know what I want? I want Perry back. I want to know what happened that night, and I'm very tempted to ask you, but I doubt I would get the truth, would I?
All right, I should say she's speaking to Reese Witherspoon, who's sort of the trouble stirrer of the four women. Willa, two things are happening in that scene, right? One is that you're introducing this new character who throws some light on the violence at the heart of the Perry character. She's Perry's mother and is a passive-aggressive wounder, you know, par excellent. I mean, she's really just a wretched, needling, sort of, you know.
I think it's psychic. A little strong. I think it's a little strong. We could get into. I don't think she's that wretched. Am I interrupting?
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting. Oh, wow. But okay. Well, maybe let's see if you agree with my second point before you demolish the first one. My second point is that simply she's also moving the plot along, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you need a new pot stirrer to come in and ask what happened on that fateful night. You know, it came, as I said, to a decisive climax in which, of course, Perry dies. And now the mystery of how that exactly happened, which could just go away, is now not going to go away because of the introduction of Meryl Streep. Anyway, what do you make of season two?
Well, it's such an interesting question, because the first three episodes, which are all that have been sent to critics, I think the first two have aired. Like, sort of like the lurking question is, like, does this show need like a big plot? Like, that is what it had sort of in the first season. We sort of were getting to this denouement, like this climax, and the whole thing was sort of framed around this horrible event had happened. Like, there was the Greek chorus of the townspeople, like the other residents of Monterey, and we knew that something terrible had happened. But we start this season and it's like we have a, you know, we're past the confines of the book that the first season was based on. Anything could happen. And you're like, oh, this is working surprisingly well as just like a show in which there is not like some huge dramatic thing about to happen. At least it's working sort of well for me. Like, I would watch these ladies do a lot of stuff. And I mean, it's not to say there's not a lot of soap opera shenanigans, because there's lots of relationship tension and, I mean, a lot of different kinds of marriages imploding and a lot of fallout from the events of last year. But like, do they need to be like getting caught or like being cornered for this, their biggest lie? And I assume that that is where it's going. And Meryl Streep's character, Mary Louise, like, does play a part in that, although there's lots of points of tension around this question. But I kind of like don't care. Like, I'm sure that's where the show is going, but yeah. I would watch them do anything.
Oh, wow. Marissa, what did you think of season one, and how do you play season two in relation to that?
So I should start up front by admitting that I started right in season two. Missed season one. I was aware of its significance as a major TV event in which all these big movie stars were doing TV. And as soon as I started season two, I realized I couldn't possibly start with season two. So I had to go back and watch the entire season in one fell swoop so that I could understand what the heck was going on. Season one, I think I agree with Willa's assessment for the most part in that I don't know that there needs to be a big reveal. I knew watching season one who had died already just from, you know, reading up about the show. And I didn't feel that the mystery necessarily drove it as much as the back and forth between the actresses and the psychological explorations into what makes all of them tick. And I feel season two seems to be setting up the same way, where, I mean, the Reese Witherspoon and Meryl Streep, every time they're in the scene together, it's electric, and that tension is really driving the show. But there's also a little bit of mystery. We're learning more about Zoe Kravitz's character, Bonnie, and her background and how she's dealing with what she's done.
Yeah. I think the thing about that show is I find it so pleasurable as like a bunch of really good actresses, like kind of doing their own like different stylistic acting in one piece that is somehow cohesively working together, kind of because of the direction and like the sort of, you know, beautiful look of the whole thing. But like, you have Reese Witherspoon, who as a producer of the show has like finagled herself this like feuding relationship with Mary Louise, like because she's like, I need scenes with Meryl Streep. So like, I won't be this daughter-in-law, but I will fight with her. That's like the most fun thing to do. You have those. And like, Meryl Streep and Reese Witherspoon are actually very different kinds of actresses, it turns out. Like, Meryl Streep is pretty naturalistic. Reese Witherspoon is very good at this like type A thing that she does, like, and Madeline is a great example of that. But they're like, you can see that they like would not, they're like oil and water just as actresses, and including in their personalities. Like, Nicole Kidman's doing her luminous, like broken, wounded thing. And then Laura Dern is on like dial 15, right? like with the scene, she's playing sort of, she's always been this like kind of brittle, overbearing, like the most heart, like the horrific mother of the group, sort of like, in that she's just like ruining her child, even though she means so well. And she has a scene where her husband has sort of lost all their money, and she like is talking to him in jail, and she's like, I will not be rich. And like, that's like the gift that's going to live forever. And like, Zoe Kravitz is doing some, you know, they're just like, it's a nice, Shailene Woodley's character is like coming in from some hippy dippy planet where like everything is fine. Like, it's just a very, you're like, these things are all very different tastes, and they taste good together.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm the only one here who sees a, or is experiencing an important discrepancy in quality between season one and season two. So I I loved season one, loved it. It's one of my favorite things to appear on TV in a long time. I kind of class it a little bit with Happy Valley, slightly, in that it both brought you into a social world whose manners and subtleties and nuances you immerse yourself in and care enormously about. At the same time, that's tied to an enormously suspenseful, thriller-esque plot. And also just in terms of the quality of the writing and the thinking behind it. So I agree with you both that the ensemble acting at the heart of it, especially these four women, is extraordinary. And that often throughout season one, I found myself thinking I would watch these four people do anything. I mean, there are multiple scenes, sometimes with all four of them, sometimes with some other configuration of the four, at a coffee shop, and just their relationship, informal relationship with the, you know, coffee boy, the barista, is fascinating. I mean, but what I realized starting to watch season two is how two supremely intelligent and plot-driven things made season one work for me. The first is that as a parent of kids, it occurred to me over and over again that at some point somebody is going to do the definitive comedy of manners about how parents get thrown together in school drop-off and pick-up, like this new thing, you know, this thing that's very reminiscent of your own experience of being a student in high school suddenly recurs in early midlife totally unexpectedly, which is you are thrown together and forced to deal with a variety of people you wouldn't otherwise deal with. And it's almost intensified because the social politics of your own kid's life and their own life chances as they're being determined by the school that they're in totally intensify the parents' reactions to one another. And social class plays out, it's the equivalent in 20th and 21st century America of the 18th and 19th century English manor house, right? It's like a place where the ways in which we all relate to each other as a social whole finally stage themselves. And when I started watching season one, I was like, someone finally fucking nailed this, right? Someone fucking nailed this. And what these people are angry all the time, and they're angry all the time at one another. And I think that captures the way parents often relate to each other, parents of kids at the same school. And then the second thing that made it, I thought, just nerve-tautening and utterly intense was it was a story with marital violence at its heart. And there are degrees of sort of psychological violence in each one of the marriages and power dynamics, which I think are subtly observed in season one. But at the heart of the whole thing is the relationship between Celeste and Perry, between Skarsgård and Nicole Kidman. And what was wise about it was not just that he was an abuser, it's that she was addicted to the abuse, and they were the one couple having intense sex still. Theirs was in some ways the most sexually alive of all the marriages because of the way in which sex was involved with rage for both of them. And it was her character having to come to grips with that addiction, her addiction to his insecurity, which fueled his possessiveness, and his possessiveness turned into violence, and then violence turned into sex. And it was her coming to understand what that cycle meant to her, how it was endangering her life and the lives of her children, and breaking it, that was the other piece at the heart of it. I mean, it is the big lie of season one that then links up, I think, quite artfully with the second big lie, which is that in an anonymous sexual encounter, Perry rapes the Shailene Woodley character and fathers this other kid. So to me, it was this convergence of the ensemble acting, the horrible wisdom about marital psychology and violence, the school drop-off comedy of manners, with the convergence, like the kind of super genre driven convergence of these two super suspenseful plots in the climax. And it's like, I find all of it's missing in season two except the ensemble acting. And so I feel like I'm watching this bizarre experience of watching what amounts to a primetime soap starring Nicole Kidman, Meryl Streep, and Reese Witherspoon, but I want it to prove me wrong so badly, and I will watch it to the end because of the quality of the acting.
Well, it's so funny because I'm like, that sounds amazing. A primetime soap starring all of these excellent actresses. That is
point taken. Point
that's
taken.
What I want, you know?
But they're a trail mix of acting styles.
Yeah, whatever. Like, this question of like whether or not this show should have a second season, I mean, this is like nothing ends anymore on television, right? Nothing ends. Like, this was supposed to be a finite show. Like, I mean, Killing Eve or Fleabag are just like two of the recent examples of things that like you're like, that first season was very good. Why are you making another one? And they just are. I think all three of those shows like are sort of remain extremely watchable, but like it's, I mean, not with Fleabag, with the other two, there may like be diminishing returns. I think this was so much better than I was expecting it to be. Like, I hear what you're saying about sort of like the tautness and certainly, the absence of Celeste and Perry's marriage as like a living thing is very pronounced. But I mean, she's still dealing with all of the, like, she's still totally entrapped in that relationship. It's just like, and it's like psychological messed upness. It's just that he's dead. So it's like the stakes are lower. But I just kind of can't believe, like, I'm just very impressed that they started from nothing again, and like it just seems like these people all seem like more and more like people. Like, I'm still very interested in it. Like, it exceeded my expectations, but maybe that's just like I had low expectations and you had high expectations.
That could be.
Well, it's hard too when you're working off a work of fiction that's already concluded. I mean, the first season was based on a book, and other shows have run into this problem: Handmaid's Tale, Game of Thrones. But the show that I keep coming back to is 13 Reasons Why.
Yeah.
In comparison to this, in that the central character of the first season sort of lingers on as a ghost, and they're making every effort to continue the relationships of the first season, even though someone is missing. I think, Steve, I don't totally disagree with you. I thought the first season did wrap up so satisfyingly that it's hard to see where they're going with this season beyond very simply, will they get caught? But it is so delicious to watch.
Also, I just want to circle back to the stuff you were saying about the school world, because on the one hand, like that's the show and it's like most satirical and like sometimes like horribly delicious, but like really over the top. I think that this idea that like, I mean, my children are not as old as your children, but it has occurred to me that there is this like weird recurrence of like you're entering these spaces that you like. It's not just like you're going back to high school, like in the sense that you are literally inhabiting like the spaces of high school. It's a very trippy, weird thing. But there is like, and this idea that anger is like the motivating feeling that everyone is having is very interesting to me. But I also think a lot of that stuff is like too easy. Like it's gotten more like there's. The principal, like these, like the women are so, particularly Laura Dern character, are so horrible in school that it does almost like it actually is like it's like the whole, it is a place where like the different vibes of the show sort of almost starts to like refract and like break up a little bit for me, where I'm like, this part of the show is like very big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, what is happening in this world is very large compared to some of the sort of like the more new, like quiet stuff that's happening. So, in the other
totally
lines.
Agree. It's a little OTT and overdrawn. I thought it worked really well in season one, and the jury is still out for me in season two. But Will, I have to ask, what grade is your kid in right now?
We're literally starting kindergarten. So I mean, like it's just begun. So I've just,
just wait.
But like even going on
by third grade, you're gonna be remade by the amount of resentment you feel towards the institution and the other parents.
I look forward to it or something, yeah. Whatever it is. Whatever.
I'm like the freaking Ancient Mariner over here. Anyway, all right. Well, it's a Big Little Lies season two. It's on HBO. Check it out. We're very curious what you think of the two seasons in relation to one another. So hit us up on social media. All right, moving on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, before we go any further, though, let's discuss what business we have. Willow, why don't we kick it off with you?
Sure. The Culture Gab Fest is going to be doing a Sally Rooney book club. They're going to be discussing Sally Rooney's new book, Normal People, on their June 26th episode. So if you'd like to read along and hear the discussion, pick up the book and join them on June 26th. I was almost going to recommend this book as my recommendation for this week, and I'm not, but it's extremely delicious. It will take you like...
I think you're still at liberty to endorse it.
It will take you like a day to read. It's like goes down like a, I don't know, really delicious drink. Bad metaphor, but it's very good. It's still summer strut time. Summer strut is our yearly collection of strutty summer songs solicited from listeners. This year, if you've got a summer strut song to add to the playlist, email summerstrut@slate.com and send us the name of the song and a Spotify link if it's available. That's summerstrut@slate.com, and we'll compile those songs onto a shareable playlist and then discuss them later in the summer on our special summer strut episode.
In Slate Plus today, we're talking about summer reading, what we are reading this summer or hope to be reading. To hear segments like that and get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program and is a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gab Fest and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gab Fest, go to slate.com/culture plus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, let's go.
The last black man in San Francisco is driven by a heartbreaking MacGuffin. Jimmy Fails' grandfather was said to be the first black man in San Francisco, and with his own hands after World War II, he built a beautiful Victorian style house in the Fillmore District, which was once known as the Harlem of the West. Thanks to a combination of all the social forces that have always separated black people in America from ownership, the house was eventually lost. The movie opens with it being occupied by white owners who do not care for it. And so Fails goes by and fixes it up without their permission. When they're evicted thanks to a estate dispute, he begins to squat there, returning it, and by implication, his own lineage to its to their former glory. And for our clip, we're going to play a bit from the trailer for the movie.
I always come back to the old house. What if it's empty? What if we just peeked inside?
We could throw parties. You could put on one of your plays. We could yell.
It is this house.
Our old house.
That's not your old house, and that's not your neighborhood.
Hey, if you're going... All right, well, I should say the movie's directed by Joe Talbot, and it stars... a man named Jimmy Fails playing a man named Jimmy Fails. The two of them are friends, and it's based partially on Fails' own experience in San Francisco. Marissa, let me start with you. What'd you make of this movie?
I thought it was gorgeous. It was beautifully shot. It was almost like it had a fairy tale quality to it that made you forget that it's actually set in 2019 at times. It has these close-ups that are loving and head-on that sort of break that create this spell that you're not just looking in on these lives, but this is a story untold. I think it was, on all things considered, they called Jimmy's Fails character, who's also called Jimmy Fails, a deposed prince, which I think is apt. This is about someone reclaiming their family legacy, and I really loved it. I flipped for it.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same way. Willow, what'd you think?
I don't know that I flipped for it. I thought it was really interesting. It is very beautiful. It's very elegiac and moody, and it's obviously like it's about gentrification in San Francisco without and being sort of explicitly about gentrification in San Francisco without actually being about all of the things you usually talk about when you're talking about gentrification in San Francisco. So, like, it's not about tech bros. It's not about Silicon Valley. I mean, those people aren't mentioned. That is, like, the background. That's the sort of – it's, like, the context. I think it's – what I liked sort of the most about it is that it felt extremely deeply thought out about sort of, like, the long tail of gentrification. I mean, there is a kind of plot twist in this movie that I don't want to spoil, but I think it's sort of like kind of fundamental to this to sort of what it's about, this idea of like when change begins, and the way that change sort of, oh, like, and gentrification in particular, sort of, there's often, I mean, there's almost always someone who is losing out. And while the movie is very explicitly about how Black people have, about like San Francisco's relationship to Black people, it's not only about that, like sort of the context of like the neighborhood that the house that Jimmy's grandfather built is in a neighborhood that was a Japanese American neighborhood that sort of was like emptied out during World War II when all the Japanese people and Americans and were interned basically, and their houses were then taken from them. And like, that's like the deep context of like where, you know, this, what, like, so it's not as if there's lots of crimes that happened. Mm-hmm. Right. And I thought I was astute about that. I think it, you know, it was like a dream. It's very beautiful. The house is like incredibly beautiful in a way that does, you know, make you long for that house. Like, it's a very, you know,
it's a storybook house, and yeah, down to the trim that Jimmy paints.
Right. It's very, it's like, it's about a lot of interesting ideas. It's about, and there's some sort of, the performances are very lovely. I think that like, it sort of works as like a mood piece. I don't know that everything, if you pushed on everything, it kind of like it's like a very assured first film. It didn't feel like a fully like, this filmmaker would get better, you know?
God, it's so funny you say that. I mean, because I agree with the specifics of everything you say, and yet it all added up to something I have to say profoundly moving to me. Like, because first of all, in a weird way, I don't think the movie's about gentrification in San Francisco. I think it's about what is it that Black people do not inherit capital, but just piles and piles of dispossession, and what to make of that fact. And you have this bizarre anomaly, which is that this guy has this really deep emotional, and he thinks, family attachment to this specific piece of real estate. And, you know, white identity in the post-war decades, like, this social contract with white America was built around home ownership and entire systems of building homes, financing homes, financing suburbs, enabling through debt your average middle class white person to own a house. And so there's this very specific social, cultural, economic inheritance that Black people were almost completely excluded from. And here's this totally anomalous story of a grandfather who, with his own hands, builds this virtual replica of a beautiful replica of a 19th century, you know, gingerbread San Francisco Victorian style house. And it was once this family's house. And can this one youngish young black man reclaim that anomaly, that inheritance, and what that means to him personally, and what that means symbolically in the context of contemporary America, and then in the context of a gentrifying San Francisco, is dealt with so thoughtfully. And then the second thing at the heart of the movie is this one friendship with, you know, so Jimmy Fails is friends with this playwright who, I mean, listen, I can only respond to this movie as a middle-aged white American, right? So I hope I am not misspeaking, but to me it was profoundly moving that this guy is attempting to be an artist, and to think and feel like an artist in the context of being surrounded by Black machismo. And he's trying to incorporate the violence inherent in street Black machismo into his own work. And that's integrated into this plot about the house in ways that I thought were quite artful and quite moving. And like whether he can do that is as much perilously at stake as to whether Jimmy Fails can end up with this house. And I liked that it was both imagistic in this Barry Jenkins style. So I think Ingu pointed out quite perceptively in her review that it's got a mood piece quality, and it's bathed in elegy the way Moonlight was. Added to which, I do think that there's a lot of like of the mutual typing and scapegoating of people in various racial categories do in Spike Lee's especially early movies that are meant to sharpen and point up the kinds of role playing that we're all trapped in. And to me, somehow the mournfulness of the Jenkins style and the kind of sharply delineated, slightly overdrawn, but quite purposeful style of Spike Lee came together and created something really thoughtful and really beautiful. Like I was really, really taken by this movie, I guess is where I come out. It's interesting, Will, that it didn't add up to something bigger than the sum of its parts for you. It sounds like.
Yeah, I thought it was moving, but it didn't. Chaos and Collins in his review for Vanity Fair sort of talked about the two protagonists. They live with the character's name is Montgomery, who's the best friend playwright. They live in Montgomery's house, which is sort of on the outskirts of San Francisco with his grandfather, Danny Glover. And it actually, too, like when you see it in sort of exteriors, is an old and small and beautiful house. It's sort of like anomalous in a neighborhood that has been, they're like, there's toxic waste in the water that they're finally starting to clean up after it's been there for, you know, scores of years, because presumably all of San Francisco is being gentrified, or, you know, they're imagining the white people they're going to move in. But there's kind of almost this Greek chorus of five other black guys who stand outside of the house and have a sort of adversarial relationship to Jimmy and Montgomery, and are kind of like a sort of like shading and shaming their sort of like lack of machismo. And in Cam's review, he sort of just talked about like, where are those people? Like, what is that? Where are they from? Like, what is violence intercedes? Like, where is that from? Like, there is this dreaminess and sort of like, you know, it does feel very much like a Greek chorus. Like, it's not, the movie's not trying to be sort of realistic in that way. But his point is to like, this is not like grounded in something. Actually made the sort of like this introduction of a bunch of these ideas about masculinity feel to him a little like a lot of ideas that weren't based in something. And I understood that. I took that point. Like one of the characters ends up coming to the house and they have this sort of like, they have a schwitz because like the new owner. And like, that's a very funny scene. And it's very interesting. And then this sort of, it takes a sort of more cliched turn with that character that I was like, that sort of sets up the denouement of the film. But I did also, I did find like, there was like a lot of pieces sort of beautifully executed, but not, you know, I thought it was a very interesting, like I think it's a really interesting first movie, basically, as I guess.
Yeah. Marissa, any tie breaking you want to do here?
I will just say that I thought the attention to detail was actually pretty extraordinary. So a lot of the scenes in the neighborhood are interrupted or punctuated by these men in hazmat suits who are cleaning up for the gentrifiers coming. And we see at one point a fish with two eyes on one side. Presumably it has four eyes because of the toxic waste. But then when they're at Montgomery's house and they're watching a movie, we hear snippets of dialogue. We don't actually see the movie, though Montgomery's describing it to his grandpa, who's blind. And the movie's actually DOA, which is a movie about a poisoning and a man who's being poisoned, but he's already dead, but he's investigating his own poisoning. And I just thought that thematic, it didn't really hammer it home. It was just a very subtle thematic connection that I thought was lovely.
I will also say that sort of the twist, like I did think, like deepened the movie in an extremely important way.
And we shouldn't spoil it, but I completely agree with that, Will.
Yeah. So,
all right. Well, the movie is The Last Black Man in San Francisco. We're in agreement that you should go see it. Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And in disagreement about how much you love it, so you can go see it and then tell us. All right. Let's move on.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
For our final segment, we're joined by Dantea Price, who's a copy editor for Slate and also writes occasionally about video gaming for Slate.com.
Thanks for having me.
Dante, I'm going to throw this to you so quickly because I have a daughter who's absolutely obsessed with Sims, plays it all the time. I look over her shoulder to see what has absorbed her in that screen so intensively. But I don't really understand the dynamics of it, the world, the appeal of it, the world building and the kind of non-competitive nature of it. So if it's okay, just explain to an old like me what Sims is about and why you play it.
The Sims is about playing God.
That is
exactly what it's about. It's got a long history of The Sims, simulations, games by Maxis, by The Sims Studios. They've always focused on being this omnipotent, omniscient being who can see everything that's going on. There was a previous series created by Will Wright in which you played a variety of simulations as an ant, as a god of a city, and you sort of determined whether your people lived or died by your hand. The Sims itself takes that and puts you in a neighborhood where you control everyday suburbia. And that's actually the premise it's run on for close to 20 years now. What if you could make yourself? What if you could make your friends, your families, your enemies? You can build their houses, get them jobs, find love, murder them in a handful of creative ways. It's somewhat cathartic, somewhat psychotic.
Should I be worried about my daughter?
No, I've been playing The Sims in its various forms for 18 years now, and I'm turning out just fine. But it's really just, it's a way to live life creatively and in a way you can set aside. It doesn't have any, you know, effect on your real life, and it allows you to do all kinds of silly things, make stories, make houses, make bad choices, and there's a save button and an undo button, and those are just so helpful.
I played like Sim City as a teenager, I think, like or a middle schooler, and that was the last time I had like had any interaction with The Sims, and like Sim City was like in black and white, and like it was, you would just make like smokestack, like you'd have to put like a nuclear reactor in to like get energy. I don't remember the details, but I turned on Sims and I was just like, firstly, like, I've not played video games in so long that I'm, like, literally not equipped to, like, pick out clothing. Like, I was just like, I need someone to tell me how to do everything. But then you get this character. So, like, you create this avatar. You make it look however you want. You give it, like, a personality and a things that it desires. And then I was first just, like, completely taken with, like, just kind of, like, how pedestrian it is. Like, they're like, here's your character. She's on a street. And, like, make a conversation with your neighbor. And I'm just like, oh, I would have to be like so much better at this to like make this interesting. And then I read the story about how basically like one of the long recurring things of Sims is that you basically are just constantly trying to like kill your Sim in creative ways. And that was amazing to me. And the part of the reason it was amazing is because I think the game, my sense is that it actually like, it's sort of encouraging you to think about creative things you could do with your Sims. And I think, you know, they do occasionally, like as it's gotten better, they do like get old and they drop dead or like some accident happens. So like you would have the experience of your Sim dying maybe by accident or not, like at your hand. But this idea that people are like building swimming pools without ladders so their Sim will just like drown in the swimming pool, like
a time-honored tradition for and, Sims players.
And there was some part of me that like found that I had like an initial like just like, whoa, that's so creepy and scary and transgressive, because like even just at the very, like the one question I had been asked was like, do you want to have like a friendly conversation with your neighbor or like a mean, like a nasty conversation with their neighbor? And I was like, I would never choose nasty. Why would I? But of course, like as I would continue to play, I'm sure I would get bored with just having friendly conversations. But this whole idea of like the playing God thing is very interesting. And obviously playing in God involves killing things. But like there, even though it's like there couldn't be a safer or more acceptable location in which to like play with and kill your totally non-real things, like something about that, like kind of I found it like creepy.
I've gone soft since I played Sims 2, I think in high school or maybe early college. I used to like burn my Sims and all kinds of gruesome things. And when Origin, which is EA's gaming platform, made Sims 4 free recently, which sort of caused this resurgence of interest in Sims, at least for those of us who are more casual gamers, I downloaded it and I fell right back into the same old habits of you start playing and then several hours pass and you think, what have I accomplished? But the level of detail in Sims 4 is kind of extraordinary. What in Sims 2, you could design your character to your specifications and you could give them personality traits. But now, I mean, you can go in and adjust how flared their nostrils are. You can give them muscles and control their weight and their body type. And in fact, if you don't make your Sims exercise, they will get fat in the game, which is something I only realized when all of my Sims were suddenly looking a little doughy. And I was like, I don't remember this. But it is amazing the ways that it has become more and more realistic in some ways. Even with aspirations, they now have goals. They can want to get married or they can want to become an artist and they can work in all different fields. They can be freelancers. What a concept that you could have this whole virtual world where all your little people have freelance gigs.
It's really, yeah.
it's like a more efficient way to kill them than taking the ladder out of the swimming pool.
Totally. I also...
Well, in The Sims 4, you can't even use the ladder trick anymore. You have to build a fence or a wall around it because they learned you can climb out of the pool without a ladder.
Yeah, they're getting smarter. They're getting smarter. Yeah.
Part of why I'm so glad we have Dantea on is that Dantea and I recently realized we have very different philosophies toward playing The Sims. So one interesting thing is that different players have found ways to modify the game. Dantea, can you tell us about some of these mods? I know there's one where toddlers can be possessed, which does not interest me. No, thank you.
Like by the devil? Or like a demon?
It's sort of like a nightmarish horror modification. There's one also that broadens the sexual horizons of the game. So inevitably, I'm sure there is somewhere out there Sims porn in a dark corner of the internet for that reason.
Oh, it's not even a dark corner. It's like a mildly shaded corner of the internet. The Sims has a really rich community. And EA has largely been very helpful in allowing its players to modify the game. There are tiny things that just allow you to make your own clothing or add some new and interesting feature to a house. There's a community, multiple communities that focus on making items that sort of increase or decrease the level of realistic behavior in The Sims. And then there are a bunch of mods that actually change the way your Sims act or react to things. The Sims 4 specifically has an emotions engine that allows you to change the mood of your players, something we weren't really sure we wanted back in 2014 in order to give up things that existed in previous installments, but has worked out really well. It comes with the same level of absurdity. Your Sims can get angry and they can literally combust if they're too angry. Or you can also just ease their anger by angry boxing or angry pooping or fighting people. But the emotions engine is a little finicky. Your Sims change their moods at the drop of a hat, so a lot of more recent mods kind of go into adjusting the quality of life so you have more emotionally stable characters. There is
super
one
wild.
And this is the mod that this is the mod that Marissa and I were talking about specifically. There is a set of emotion-based mods by a user named I assume it is Roberkey that just kind of tweaks the emotions engine to make your Sims more human in a way that's actually very desirable. They don't become ecstatic when they just come home for the day and they get an A+ on their report card. They become ecstatic at big life events, like when they get married or when they have children or when they get engaged. And it sort of stabilizes and humanizes the Sims in a way that I feel like, as a long-term player, is much more desirable because the killing gets old. The day-to-day absurdity gets old, and you want to build something deeper and richer as you continue playing a game that you've definitely dumped thousands of hours into your life into and don't want to think about that very much.
So, like, what is your, like, what do you do in Sims now?
Me?
Yeah.
I personally create a fresh save. I have a variety of Sims 4 expansion packs, so I adjust the neighborhoods to meet my needs. I put, you know, salons and spas and restaurants, and I take one family at a time, and I just sort of build them out. I flesh out the days of their lives with new jobs. I try a mechanic that maybe I'm not as familiar with, like owning a restaurant or being a freelancer or becoming a pet person. The pets expansion like completely eludes me, unlike previous expansions. The animals are actually autonomous, so you just kind of have to guess at what they want and what they do. And there's a lot of consistent and constant learning when I play, because I will binge for days or weeks at a time, and then I'll set it down for months or wait for the next expansion to come out. It's just it's a very mood based game.
See, where Dante and I differ in our Sims philosophies is that she has, you know, this mod that will modify the game so that your Sims' emotions are kept in check. And I play God. I'm a benevolent God. I want my Sims to be happy all the time. I have their house. I've used a cheat so that they have more money than they'll ever need. Their house is lavishly decorated. It's so nicely decorated that they're happy just from being home. And I control their lives to try to max out their skills. What's frustrating and also entertaining about the game is that my Sims do not cooperate with this. Like, I want them to be expert cooks and well-read and have a lot of friends. But if you leave them alone and there's a computer in the house, they will inevitably go play a computer game, which I look at myself and I'm like, that's exactly what I'm doing right
now. Does them playing a computer game make them less happy, like, in the game?
They have fun. They enjoy it. But I'm like, I have these very clearly set goals for you, and you are off playing The Sims inside the game, which is exactly what I'm doing in real life.
Oh my God. And
it's
I love the fact that
they
could
do default.
Yeah, that you could unleash this infinite regress of Sims within Sims within Sims within Sims. But as a first order proposition, it sounds exactly like parenting.
I mean, maybe a little bit.
I think that the input to output is not as exact. It's like more.
Wait. In which one is it exact?
Well, no. Like the children are more like the pets. Like, you don't know what they want.
I mean, even within the game, though, there are different life stages. You can have babies and toddlers and such. And I want all of my families to be happy in ways that I guess are not realistic because I am controlling everyone's movements.
I'm interested. How much do you guys like do it as like a home decor exercise?
A lot. I spend a lot of time designing the houses. To me, I don't.
Almost none.
Really? To me, it's
I cannot. I am just not for that.
I love that. I love the. It's almost like an architecture simulator for me more than a lifestyle simulator. Like, I will get bored just controlling my Sims' lives after a couple of hours, but I love designing the houses. Once the neighborhood is full, I'm pretty much done, and I can wait until the next Sims is released.
I sort of love the idea that for some people, playing God means just, you know, hiring out for an interior decorator. Like, God doesn't bother with the draperies and the mid-century modern, picking out the mid-century modern furniture pieces. Dante, I suspect that kind of like playing Sims, we could do this forever and iterate out into further worlds until, you know, we'd created some intricate Borgesian totality. But we typically limit our segments to about 10 minutes, so can I thank you here and ask you to please come back on the show to talk about video games or anything else apposite?
Always. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. Awesome. Great to have you on.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Willa, what do you have?
Okay, I'm going to endorse an article, or really a trend that was recently in the New York Times last week. It was in the style section this weekend. It's about a YouTube star who makes a living eating huge quantities of food for her audience.
What a dream.
It's called mukbang. It's a Korean word. She is an American. And it's like this crazy, basically she was sort of doing YouTube stuff and she realized that she was getting like more and more viewers. She would like just eat these, like the pictures in the story are like her eating crab legs, but just like these feasts. And she has a million followers. Like it's this whole insane world where it's like a cross of people who are like into ASMR, like the sort of the sound of her eating. Also people who like want company while they're eating. People who like, I'm sure it's a sex thing for some people. I'm sure it's like probably like an eating disorder thing for other people. It's just like this whole amazing YouTube world. And I am just like, YouTube is unbelievable. I have relatively little to do with it, but just like the deep weird communities of people that are interested in different things, like it is never not fascinating. And this one was like a particularly fascinating one. It's called The Queen of Eating Shellfish Online, and it's a New York Times article, and it's about her name is Bethany Gaskin, and she binge eats food on YouTube, but like she's not like has so many YouTube followers that she only eats at all when she's being filmed, so she eats twice a day for YouTube. So it's not like, I mean, it's really just like a whole fall down the rabbit hole. It's a wild thing.
That is wild. I was not expecting that. It's quite a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Marissa, what do you got?
Mine is not nearly so eccentric. I'm going to endorse a show that is near and dear to my heart, and that is Schitt's Creek. It is a CBC show that airs on Pop in the U.S. The first four seasons are also on Netflix. I recently wrote about Schitt's Creek for Slate. It's just a cult show that has amassed this devoted following recently. It's almost at its end. It just wrapped its fifth season. Its next season will be its last. But it's about a wealthy family who loses everything, very Arrested Development-like premise. And they take refuge in a small town called Schitt's Creek that they bought as a joke for the name. And a lot of the first season is them trying to interact with normal people and this podunk town with its crude name. But then in the second season, something extraordinary happens. The show finds a wonderful heart. It is so sweet. The performance by Catherine O'Hara in particular as the matriarch of the family, who is also this soap opera star with an implacable accent, is not to be missed. And I highly recommend it.
It's so funny. My wife has started watching it. I think has binged the entirety of it. And what she keeps saying is, it's so funny and I never laugh. It's so perfect and I have no idea why. Like, it's just, there's something so itself about it that you can't, there's no basis of comparison in a weird way. And there's it's a experience of total rapture to watch it. And she just has no analytic vocabulary for why.
It is very hard to nail down. And part of why I tell people to start in the second season, and I made a case for that in the piece for Slate, is because if you start with the pilot, it's a much meaner show at the beginning. And I think you won't really understand what it is that je ne sais quoi, you know, quality until you get deep in the weeds.
It sounds like Parks and Recreation in that way, actually.
A little bit. In that it finds its heart later on. Yeah.
As a kid who used to stay up till all hours to watch the very, very original SCTV back in the late 1970s, it is amazing to me that not only these people became, all of them became famous, but that so many of them persisted and stayed. I mean, Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, they were the original cast, I think, back in like, this is like 1978, maybe, on that show. It's just amazing what they've done. Anyway, I'm very curious to hear from my co-panelists whether what I'm endorsing is just so already discovered that this is like value-free endorsement. But really, thanks to the Big Little Lies soundtrack, I got to say, Martha Wainwright was kind of new to me. I mean, I know Loudon Wainwright. I know Rufus Wainwright. I really was not familiar with Martha Wainwright's music. And there's a song of hers on the soundtrack. I was like, "Who? What is that? That's amazing." And so I tracked down her first eponymous LP from 2005. Martha Wainwright has been on in heavy rotation in my household. She's an incredible songwriter and singer. The daughter of Loudon Wainwright, the third legendary folk singer, but also Kate McGarrigle, equally legendary folk singer, probably best known for the McGarrigle sisters, who are made some of my favorite music of all time. But she is amazing. I really love that record. Do you guys listen to her at all?
I think this was a good endorsement in that neither of us was like, "Oh, Martha, of course."
Just to give you like a little bit of a taste, and maybe we can go out on the song. The song that was playing on Big Little Lies that's on that first album is called Bloody Motherfucking Asshole. And it just has this like verve, rage-driven verve to it. At the same time, there's something like kind of like lilting and beautiful and McGarrigle-esque about it. Who could pull that off other than Martha Wainwright? So check it out. I think that's a great record and a great song.
Like those guys with guitars. I've been watching in bars who've been stamping their feet to a different beat, to a different beat, to a different beat. I will not pretend, I will not put on a smile, I will not say I'm all right for you, when all I wanted was to be good, to do everything in true, to do everything in true. You bloody motherfucking asshole. Are you bloody motherfucking asshole?
All right, Marissa, thank you so much for coming in and joining us. That was really fun.
Thanks, Steve.
Will, it is always a huge pleasure to have you on this show. What else can I say?
Thank you. See you soon, I hope.
Yep.
Before we go, we just wanted to give a shout out to some new Slate Plus members who listed the Culture Gab Fest as their favorite show. Scott Middleton from Somerville, Massachusetts. Amy Kaufman from Sleepy Hollow, New York. Alex Tobin from Utrecht, Netherlands. Amanda Young from Melbourne, Australia. Eric J. from Los Angeles. Walter Azevedo from New York. Brett Robb from North Geelong. Matthew Price from Brooklyn. Ian Jacobs from San Francisco. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today. That's at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. We do have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. We like to be interacted with. By and large, our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Alex Barish. For Marissa Martinelli and Willa Paskin, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a fun show. We'll see you soon.